It's a pleasure for the court to be hearing oral arguments here at the Widener Law School. Dean Emmons, thank you for having us. I don't want counsel to be intimidated by either the audience or the jury. The jury are our law clerks, and they don't have a vote. We're ready to hear arguments. Are you ready to proceed?
Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the court, Robin Grogan for appellees PMA Insurance Company and CNA Insurance Company. I rise this morning to introduce co-counsel Jared Emig from the law firm of Gleason, Flynn, Emig, and Fogelson. Mr. Emig has been admitted pro hoc vice in this case and will be presenting arguments on behalf of the appellees.
Thank you. Welcome to the court.
Thank you.
May it please the court, I represent the appellant, Dr. Santosh Reddy, in this case. If I may, let me start with some factual background, which will be important relative to the two issues that are present in this case. This is a medical malpractice, medical negligence claim, which was tried in the Superior Court for Sussex County. As a result of that trial, a verdict was entered against Dr. Reddy. It arises from treatment of a child by the name of Nikki Spriggs. Nikki was born in Washington, D.C. She was treated at a facility in Washington, D.C., and there came a time when the District of Columbia then contracted to have her care transferred to an institution or facility in Lewis, Delaware. At the time that she was there, she was seen in consultation by my client, Dr. Reddy. Dr. Reddy evaluated her. After he did his evaluation, he made a recommendation that she go to the AI DuPont Hospital for evaluation. Part of the evaluation was relative to a condition on her spine called scoliosis. She ended up going to the AI DuPont Hospital. After she went to AI DuPont, was evaluated by a pediatric orthopedist by the name of Dr. Dabney. Dr. Dabney made a recommendation that she be brought back regularly for evaluation of her scoliosis. Under the arrangements which were in place at that time, she was under the care of the facility, which was Harbor Health. Harbor Health had the responsibility to make sure that she was transported up for her visits. Harbor Health failed to do that. As a consequence of that, Nikki Spriggs did not get the evaluations that had been recommended at AI DuPont. That process started in 1992, and it was not until 1998 that she finally reached AI DuPont again under the care of Dr. Dabney. And at that point in time, he makes a recommendation that her scoliosis has gone to a point where she now needs surgery. She, at that point in time, Dr. Dabney, who believes that she needs surgery to correct the problem, makes that recommendation, and in order to have the surgery performed, he has to get approval from her guardian. Her guardian is the District of Columbia. The District of Columbia declines to give consent, and there's a process that's going on in the 1998 time period. While that process is going on, Nikki Spriggs passed away. Subsequent to that, her family initiates a lawsuit in the District of Columbia. They initiate that lawsuit against the District of Columbia for their failure to do what should have been done for Nikki Spriggs. They also sued Harbor Health, saying that they did not follow up with the visits as had been recommended by Dr. Dabney.
Was one of the allegations in that case in the District of Columbia relating to the refusal to give consent for the surgery?
It was part of it because of the fact that there had been a delay and there were multiple counts that were in that action.
Were the claims brought against those defendants in the D.C. court, did they arise under D.C. law or Delaware law or what law?
Well, they were raised under the District of Columbia law because they did have jurisdiction there. And obviously, a claim against the District of Columbia would be D.C. law.
So it wasn't a Delaware malpractice action? There wasn't any claim under the Delaware malpractice?
I don't believe so. I don't believe that Delaware law was applied to that.
And Dr. Reddy, your client was not a party to the D.C. suit?
That's correct. That's correct.
And that's because according to the record, he had no contact with the District of Columbia, and they really couldn't serve him or bring him into the suit any other way.
Well, that's the argument is, but there was no attempt to bring him in either by a third-party action, and frankly, even the way the case was defended in Washington, D.C., there was no allegation that Dr. Reddy had done anything wrong. It wasn't the subject of the initial complaint filed against Harbor Health was that they were negligent. There was no mention of the fact that Dr. Reddy did anything wrong. But there would be potentially an argument that he could have been included in some form or an action initiated in Delaware to preserve any claims that they may or may not have.
I think we're familiar with the operative facts based on what you've told us so far. So you want to start with your legal arguments?
Yes, Your Honor. Yes, Justice Holland. The first argument is the application of the statute of limitations, and let me start by saying that the trial court had indicated and agreed that there's no dispute that this is a medical negligence claim. This case was handled as a medical negligence claim. The lawsuit that was filed, the complaint, alleged medical negligence. Under our statutes, in order to have a claim for medical negligence, you have to file an affidavit of merit. That was done in this case. The evidence that proceeded in the case, it was tried as a medical negligence claim. The jury instructions were of a nature which was a medical negligence claim. So there is no dispute, even at the time that I argued in the underlying case, that Dr. Reddy should have been dismissed by statute of limitations. The court agreed it was a medical negligence claim. In that circumstance, the controlling statute of limitations...
Well, to be more precise, it was a medical negligence claim for contribution, wasn't it?
Sure. It was a medical negligence claim, but they're arguing in essence, and this is what their argument is against my position in the case, is, well, this is a contribution claim. Therefore, it's not a medical malpractice claim. But the statutes I submit to the court are clear that if your cause of action arises from a claim of medical negligence, then the two-year statute of limitation applies.
Well, if it's a medical negligence claim, then the two-year statute applies, and the claim would against Reddy would have been barred, time barred.
Sure, it would have.
But if the characterization of the claim, or the proper characterization, is that it's a contribution claim, then the three-year statute applies, and the suit would be timely.
In that circumstance, if the court were to say that the three...
Answer is yes.
I'm sorry?
The three-year statute applied, then there would be no time bar.
If the three-year statute applied.
Okay. Now, would you agree that there's a distinction between an original claim for malpractice, where that is the cause of action, and a claim for contribution, where the malpractice is evidentiary in determining what the apportionment of liability should be?
I do not believe that distinction exists under the...
So in other words, no matter how you characterize the claim, if you're using malpractice evidence to prove percentage of fault, then it's a malpractice claim, and therefore the statute, the two-year statute would apply.
It would, and if I may give...
Wouldn't we have to throw out all of the law of contribution in order to accept your position?
As to a medical negligence claim, assuming that the claim is not asserted within the two-year time period, it would not be applicable.
So let's just go back to the facts. In the District of Columbia case, the District of Columbia settled for $1.2 million. Harbor Health settled for $725,000. And the suit was brought in Delaware by Harbor Health alone for contribution from Dr. Reddy. And the allegation is, we've paid $725,000, but in essence we've overpaid because Dr. Reddy should be contributing to the amount that we did pay. With regard to the statute of limitations, before they paid the $725,000, how would they have written the complaint? You know, the argument is the statute should run on, this should be a contribution statute of limitations, and you really can't know when to bring suit until you've quantified the overpayment, for want of a better term. You're arguing that they should have brought the suit earlier. My question is, until you've paid the money, how do you write your lawsuit? What are you asking for in your lawsuit?
Well, if the two-year statute has expired, you don't have a claim, so you can't write anything. And if the court's argument is...
The court only asks questions.
I agree.
No argument. I'm trying to understand the application of your rule of law. You're saying they should have paid, they should have filed before they ever paid the $725,000. My question is, what does the complaint look like? At the end of the complaint, you say, wherefore I want X dollars, and X has never been determined. What do you write in that complaint?
Well, that actually would be a third-party complaint. So, I mean, if you want to preserve your right to have contribution from another tortfeasor, you'd file a third-party complaint. And that's routinely done in the circumstance where you've not established the amount of liability either by contribution, but that's how you would do
it. So you're saying Harbor Health should have brought Dr. Reddy into the District of Columbia lawsuit?
Or file it here in the state of Delaware where they had jurisdiction over him.
I would like to understand how this would work, your rule of law that you're proposing, in the context of, let's assume everyone's in Delaware, so you don't have this jurisdictional issue about service.
Right.
And in a regular medical negligence action, it's not unusual for all the defendants to file cross claims against each other for contribution, correct?
Correct.
Okay. But those cross claims, by definition, are going to be part of the answer that's filed by the defendants. Yes?
Correct.
Now, if someone files suit on the last day of the statute of limitations, and that identifies all of the defendants because they're all right here in Delaware, and the cross claims are filed, under your rule that you're proposing, wouldn't they all be subject to dismissal because they're barred by the statute of limitations?
They would be. And
well, then how can someone other than the hospital or one of the doctors initiating a medical negligence action against someone else? Is that the remedies to avoid that? If a hospital knows that the statute is about to run, that they must then file a lawsuit against their own doctors for contribution?
I understand what the concern is in terms of the inequity and the unfairness of that, because that's in essence what it says is, well, they don't have the right to pursue those claims. But we live in a jurisdiction where we have joint and several liability. And in terms of looking at this, you could say that if they are precluded under the statute, it's unfair. It's unfair because they can't pursue their claims. But I would...
Don't you eliminate the inequity and unfairness by simply recognizing a distinction between an original claim for contribution and an original claim for malpractice? An original claim for malpractice, assuming again everything is in Delaware, with all the with all the defendants from D.C. now being in Delaware, or all the defendants being in Delaware.
You do.
Rule would be that if the original action is for malpractice, then you have a two-year statute of limitation. But you don't even have a claim for contribution until fault or disproportionate fault has been established by some form of adjudication. That is, the statute doesn't even start to run until Harbor is found to be culpable for malpractice and pays a disproportionate share of the liability.
But what the court would be then saying is that, well, we're now going to recognize that statute of limitations is based on accrual, when you're accrual of your cause of action. And so that's what the contribution argument would be, when your claim doesn't accrue until you make your payment.
That's correct.
Right? And what I would then argue to the court is that you would then be saying insurance companies can go back and get their money based on an accrual claim, but the statute of limitations that exists in this state does not let a plaintiff have a cause of action based on accrual. I could share with the court.
But isn't that really the heart of the question here? And that's the text of our medical malpractice statute. And the other side argues in their brief that the medical malpractice statute contemplates the plaintiff being a patient and the defendant being the health care provider. And here, that's not what we have in the contribution setting.
But there's no distinction to Dr. Reddy. He's been sued for medical negligence, and he has a claim against him.
Sued for contribution, and in order to recover the contribution, you have to prove that he was medically negligent. But it's a subset of the claim for contribution. My question to you is, doesn't the text of the Delaware medical malpractice statute read that the plaintiff is a patient and the defendant is a health care provider?
I don't recall that it says that specifically, but the two statutes, the statutes that are issue in this case, and then I did cite 8129 says, which is, it says health care malpractice actions, and that's in Title 10. It says no action for the recovery of damages. So when they're talking about actions, and they say action, and they're applying the three-year statute.
Well,
which
it's qualified, isn't it? It's qualified based upon tort or contract, the medical statute of limitations. And if so, isn't this a statutory cause of action?
Well, it says under 8129, it says no action shall be brought. 8128, no action for recovery of damages, whether in the form of a tort action or breach of contract action, shall be brought, and then it applies the statute.
Well, what is this action? Isn't this a statutory action? Because at common law, was there no right of contribution?
Well, and then I go back to the original application of the statute of limitations, which is that applies to all medical negligence claims. Ultimately, the court has said on numerous occasions that the reason why the statute of limitations, which is so harsh to plaintiffs, individual plaintiffs, was set in motion and was the law of the land, was to eliminate.
Well, help me understand what a claim for contribution is. Is it a claim based in tort, contract, or statute?
It's actually a cause of action that's based on the common law in the state of Delaware. It's also a statutory claim. But so is wrongful death. Wrongful death is a statutory claim, and it's subject to the law applicable to the statute of limitations. In a malpractice case, if you cause the death of a patient, you have a claim that's a statutory claim. It's wrongful death. That two-year statute of limitations applies to it, and there is no distinction.
But we do have a contribution statute, don't we?
You do.
So it's the sort of the general or generalized contribution statute among joint tort cases. Isn't the problem here that we have that statute that exists totally apart from the medical malpractice statute, and then we have the medical malpractice statute, which doesn't have embedded within it a contribution provision that's peculiar to medical malpractice? And basically, your side is arguing that we have to, because of that silence, we have to assume that the right to contribution is subsumed within the statute of limitations for medical malpractice and ignore the application of the general statute.
Well, the only thing I would say in response to that is when the statutes were enacted in 1976 in response to what was at that time a concern about a medical malpractice crisis, that was why these statutes were enacted. It was to say any claim arising from an allegation of medical negligence, medical malpractice, that these statutes would override it. Every time this court has addressed those issues.
Well, let me ask the question a different way then before you complete your answer. You can argue that because the legislature, when it adopted the medical malpractice statute, didn't address the issue of contribution among the defendants, that it was relegating those issues to the area, the sphere of the general contribution statute, the rules that would apply in that context. You're arguing the opposite. You're arguing that we have to infer that because there was no treatment of contribution in the medical malpractice statute, that statute was intending basically to negate the application of the general contribution statute.
That's one of the reasons why I cited as an example the savings statute. Savings statute is a general statute available for all causes of action in the state of Delaware. This court twice, and I have already...
Your answer is yes, the legislature was intending...
That's correct.
...that the contribution statute not apply in the medical malpractice context.
No, it would not apply. In other words, the statute limitations...
At least for limitations purposes.
Right. And the reason why I cited the Fattori case and also the Taylor case, which I was involved in both sides of those two matters, the Supreme Court has said that the savings statute doesn't apply because the statute of limitations overrides that. And so all statutes in this state are overridden by that. I know I have 20 seconds left on my time. I've only my last...
You have 20 seconds left on your total time. So we've used up your reserve time with our questions. So I would suggest that you stop, and we'll allow you to reply for 2 minutes.
Thank you.
Good morning. May it please the Court, Jared Emig on behalf of Harbor Healthcare and its insurance carriers, CNA and PMA. I won't belabor the facts to the Court, but really the underlying case, it's significant because it created the perfect storm for my clients, Harbor Health, in the District of Columbia. And as a result of this perfect storm, we had this underlying litigation from 2001 all the way through 2006. And respectfully, Your Honors, this is an extreme case for Dr. Reddy to be held liable for contribution in 2010 when he rendered care in 92 and 98.
But does anywhere in the record reflect whether your client tried to bring Dr. Reddy into the District of Columbia case?
Your Honor, the appellants included my letter, my evaluation letter, in the, I believe, in the appendix, which discusses Dr. Reddy to my clients. We produced our evaluation letters that I was writing in the underlying case, evaluating the underlying case, and we did that to prove to the jury that the underlying case was settled fairly and reasonably. And in that letter, I addressed that, based upon our research, Dr. Reddy can't be brought into the suit because he didn't have the significant contacts with the District of Columbia that Harbor Health did.
Right, so now it's suggested that what you should have done, once you made that realization, and once you were in litigation in the District of Columbia, is brought suit against Dr. Reddy in Delaware for contribution.
And respectfully, I think I would have been met with a motion to dismiss simply because the contribution statute says my cause of action doesn't arise until I make payment and I discharge any potential liability of Dr. Reddy. So it's an inchoate right, and that's what all of these cases talk about. That I have no ability to assert this cause of action until I discharge not only my client's liability, but also Dr. Reddy's.
Which jurisdiction's law would apply to that?
Well, that's a good question. That's the perfect storm in this case. When we were hauled into the District of Columbia, and over the 5 years, we were met with difficult conflict of law questions, and the most difficult one was the statute of limitations. And this claim would have been subject to the District of Columbia because District of Columbia law says they're going to apply the district statute of limitations. I think that if I would have attempted to assert a cause of action against Dr. Reddy, it would have been under the Delaware statute for a contribution, and I would have had to have satisfied the elements of the Delaware statute because, at least in my underlying action with the District of Columbia, my client would have been judged by the standard of care of Delaware. They were making allegations that statutes that apply in Delaware with respect to nursing homes could be used to establish the standard of care. And I think to reach out and try to recover the disproportionate share paid by my client, I would have to rely on Delaware law.
Well, Mr. Emig, just so I have the facts clear, is a theoretical matter, your client could have tried to third-party in Dr. Reddy in the D.C. underlying action.
We could have.
But hear me out.
Certainly.
Is it correct that a strategic determination was made not to do that because there would be an immediate motion to dismiss on grounds that Dr. Reddy wasn't amenable to service in D.C.?
Honestly, Your Honor, it was twofold. One, it was our evaluation of the law, so that was legal strategy. And secondly, it was also factual strategy. I point out in this letter, the evaluation letter that was admitted into evidence, and it's part of this record, that
it's one thing to say that for strategic reasons it would have been undesirable to third-party in Dr. Reddy, but my question is, was it legally possible? And I think your answer is no because of the jurisdictional issues, but if that's wrong, tell me.
That is correct, Your Honor. I have no judicial determination backing me up on that, but our evaluation of the complete lack of contacts with Dr. Reddy.
And the record reflects that the District of Columbia, who was the guardian, for want of a better term, and then they decided by contract to send the child to Delaware under the care of Harbor Health. So all of the contacts in the District of Columbia were between the district making the arrangements with Harbor Health. Once all of that was in place, Dr. Reddy came into the picture through his arrangement with Harbor Health. So he, according to the record, had no contact with the District of Columbia at all. Is that correct?
That's correct, Your Honor. In fact, in the underlying case, one of the reasons it took so long was I filed a motion to dismiss challenging jurisdiction against Harbor Health in the District of Columbia. So there was an extended period of discovery just focused on the jurisdictional. And what was established was that my client opened up this pediatric ward and not only solicited business by telephone, they actually came into the District of Columbia, put on a presentation because the District of Columbia had this many children that were in severe need of specialized care, Nikki Spriggs being one of them. And the district had no place to put them, so they sent them, they agreed and sent them to Harbor. And then throughout the six-year residency, my client had to submit periodic reports to the District of Columbia, this continuing contacts. Dr. Reddy was contacted by Harbor Health, and he had no contacts with the District of Columbia.
Okay, so you're basically the suit proceeds without Dr. Reddy in D.C. It goes to a judgment or a settlement, and your client pays what it considers to be a disproportionate share of the liability. So it then, at that point, brings an action in Delaware, this action against Dr. Reddy, who until this point has never been sued for malpractice or anything else. And that suit takes place how many years after the last act of alleged wrongdoing?
Your Honor, the last act of wrongdoing would have been as late as 1997-1998.
And the lawsuit against Dr. Reddy in Delaware was filed when?
2008. I filed it shortly before 2 years after the settlement. Okay. The settlement was in 2006.
It was in the 2 years of settlement, but 10 years after the last conceivable act of malpractice.
Yes, sir.
Doesn't that create a problem on your side? That is, we're being told, and there seems to be some arguable merit to it, that one of the policies underlying the malpractice statute was to make as efficient as possible and as short as possible malpractice proceedings. What happened here is that you had two separate malpractice proceedings 10 years apart at a time when memories could have faded, witnesses might be unavailable. Can you square that result with what the malpractice statute was intended to do?
Your Honor, I'll wholeheartedly concede that it was an extreme set of facts and those difficulties were present. I can't deny that. But as I said before, this case turned out to be the perfect storm against my client.
And well, whether it was a storm or perfect depends, I guess, on which way the wind is blowing.
Right. Hope it's blowing this way.
What is so extreme about these facts? I mean, why is that important?
The only The appellants are arguing that because Dr. Reddy is being held up for judgment for care and treatment that he rendered 12 years before he was brought into suit is unfair and unreasonable. But when you look at the plain language of the statute, that the cause of action for contribution is inchoate, it doesn't attach or doesn't accrue until this payment is made. The legislature can't predict every potential possible extreme case, and unfortunately this was an extreme case for Harbor Health, who is also a health care provider. I would like to address the issue of legislative history because the appellants addressed that. And
Well, before you do that, are you telling us that it's an extreme case or perhaps an outlier? Because as Justice Holland suggested in one of his questions, the malpractice statute really envisioned a case where all of the parties were in Delaware before the court at the same time, in which case this would have been done a lot faster. That is both the liability aspect of the case and the contribution aspect. But here you have the liability aspect being litigated in a jurisdiction outside of Delaware. And then, years later, do you have the contribution component being litigated in Delaware?
It's clearly an outlier, and I think the way the statutes are written, it's envisioned that everything will be hopefully wrapped up in one litigation, the third-party defendants are brought in. But unfortunately, under these facts, which were not envisioned and not addressed by the legislature, we didn't have that luxury.
I'd like to ask you a question about the causation issue and the consent by the District of Columbia as the guardian. Was that argued to the jury or to the fact finder in this case?
I believe it was, Your Honor.
So that, as a matter of factual determination by the verdict, was resolved in your favor?
Yes, Your Honor.
All right. The other causation issue I'd like you to address is the second argument in the appellant's brief that assuming you prevail on the statute of limitations argument and the proceeding could go forward, in that in your contribution case you had to prove malpractice and that you failed to have expert testimony, and as a matter of law, Dr. Reddy should have prevailed. So what's your position with regard to the need for you to have an expert?
Your Honor, our position is that there was no expert testimony to testify that the District of Columbia, there's no expert on District of Columbia receivers or guardians saying that had this situation been presented, the District of Columbia would have approved. Our position is that that's not a technical, it's not a medical issue, and there was abundant circumstantial evidence to show that had it been presented to the District of Columbia, it would have been approved. Let me first start with the expert testimony from Dr. Reddy that was presented, and it's in the abstract. Dr. Dabney, who is, everybody concedes, one of the foremost experts on cerebral palsy scoliosis, he testified that the rate of Nikki's curvature was 3% per month between 92 and 98, and that the optimum time for the surgery would have been 95 and 96, and that's right square in the time when my client and Dr. Reddy didn't return her to AI DuPont. Dr. Dabney testified that had he been given the opportunity to do the surgery, there would have been more than a 50% chance of it improving her spine, extending her life, and making her more comfortable. Also, what was presented to the jury was that during the same time frame, the District of Columbia approved two different surgeries, a pretty substantial revision of her tracheostomy and a hip resection where a local doctor actually cut out Nikki's hip. And in both instances, the District of Columbia acted promptly. She was given medical clearance, and the surgery was performed, and she survived. The other circumstantial evidence, and it's glossed over really in everyone's brief, is that in the letter that I wrote, and this went to the jury, the District of Columbia ultimately approved the surgery in October of 1998, about a month before Nikki's death. And that's significant because the appellants are arguing the District of Columbia never approved it. Well, they did approve it, but unfortunately she died before the surgery could be scheduled. The surgery that was being proposed in 98 was a far more drastic and complicated surgery. It was a posterior and an anterior approach, because the spine not only curved, it also became more rigid. Dr. Dabney testified that had the surgery been done in 95 or 96, it would be a much less complex surgery. It would only be a posterior approach. It wouldn't have the significant recovery time that this finally approved surgery.
There was only a 35% angle deformity.
Exactly.
By the time you get to 1997, it's 85%.
And then progresses off the charts to 110. So, Your Honor, respectfully, that answers the court's question, but our position is that there's abundant testimony in the record for the jury easily to find that had Dr. Reddy done what he was supposed to do and had my client done what it was supposed to have done, that the District of Columbia would have approved the surgery, just like it had in the two prior instances. And we do have medical expert testimony saying had it been done, it had this better than 50% chance of
prevailing. I'm sorry, you did have that testimony?
Yes, Your Honor, we did.
Okay. And I understand, or at least I sense from your briefs, that there's another argument that you're making, and that is that, this whole thing could have been avoided had there been periodic referrals of the patient back to the Delaware facility, at which point, the whole issue of surgery could have been taken up in a timely way. Because that wasn't done, in effect, the other side, would be benefiting from its own failure to observe to do what they should have done, and made it impossible to make that judgment, at least in real time.
Exactly, Your Honor. And in any case, a misread X-ray or some failure to diagnose, the defense could argue, well, had it been recommended, maybe the surgery would not have been done correctly. I don't think anywhere in the law it's the plaintiff's burden to rule out every potential problem with the required course of treatment. Your Honor, let me just end that when you look at it, Dr. Reddy was held 25%. I think the interesting part of the Delaware contribution statute, as opposed to the ones in the jurisdictions where I practice, is it allows the fact finder to apportion, and that's exactly what the jury did in this case. They held Dr. Reddy 25% liable, recognizing the liability of my client, potentially the liability of the District of Columbia. So this was an opportunity for the statutes to work. And respectfully, they worked in an equitable fashion.
Okay, well, before you conclude, going back to Justice Ridgely's question and my question on causation, let me see if I understand your answer. In the second argument raised by the appellant says the problem here is an error of law because you did not have an expert. You responded you didn't need an expert. It's really a factual question. If we look at the appellant's reply brief, it appears that the appellant switched ground because I'm reading on the reply brief on page 12, and the appellant says, the defense is not arguing that the plaintiff needs expert testimony to establish that the District of Columbia would have consented to the proposed surgery. The defense was arguing that Dr. Dabney did not know if the district would have consented to the surgery if it had been presented in 95 or 96. So at least the way I read the appellant's argument, they started off with an issue of law about the absence of expert testimony, and in their reply brief, appear to agree with you that it's a question of fact. And your answer to the court this morning is the record citations that support the proposition that the district ultimately consented, and that was a determination the jury could make. Is that correct?
It's the fact that the district ultimately consented in 98, albeit too late, and that they consented on the two prior surgeries within the time frame of this 96 or 95 to 97 range when it would have been more optimum. So I can't prove something that was never given the chance to occur, but I can show a course of conduct, and I can show other facts from which the jury could say, well, the district was presented with opportunities, and they essentially rubber-stamped these two prior surgeries. We get to 97, 98. My letter shows that there's at that time this change of regime in the District of Columbia. The District of Columbia was being presented with a far more taxing and complex surgery than would have been presented earlier. So based on that, the jury had more than ample evidence to say, had the district been provided the opportunity, sure, they would have consented.
Well, and what they would have been presented with is that Nikki was in significant pain and her spine was deteriorating at a rate of 3% every month.
They would have had the benefit of Dr. Dabney's six-month reports from 92 to 95, documenting the progression, and that would have been a far different case.
I just have a question conceptually. Were you trial counsel and also a witness in this case?
Your Honor, it sure seemed like it bordered on that. It was a very complicated segregation case, a contribution case to try, because my evaluations in the underlying case played a central role. I never testified, certainly. What I did was to call a plaintiff's attorney in the underlying case as an expert witness, and he was a wonderful witness. And he explained to the jury District of Columbia law. He explained some of the tactical decisions he was making. But my actions were certainly a part, because I had to prove that our settlement was fair and reasonable. And my evaluations were scrutinized very closely in the trial in Delaware.
But did anyone make a motion to have you disqualified?
No, Your Honor. And there was no expert testimony against us saying it was not a fair and reasonable settlement.
Well, you might take a look at our court's decision in the Waters case about being a witness and attorney at the same time. And I understand you weren't a witness, but clearly your letters were a significant part of the documentary evidence.
Yes, Your Honor.
Thank you.
Thank you, Your Honor.
I'm going to set the clock at 2 minutes.
Thank you, Justice Holland. You were asking the question about this being an anomaly and the fact that it's 10 years later that this malpractice claim is being asserted as to Dr. Reddy. Let me suggest something to the court in terms of the consequences of what may occur if the court says that contribution claims can then be presented or initiated after a judgment is entered or a settlement is made. At this juncture, as we stand here today, it is less than 2 years or 3 years from the day of the judgment against Dr. Reddy. If the court says that the statute of limitations does not apply, then that means at this point in time, Dr. Reddy has the right to file a claim against anybody that he believes or his counsel believes may have caused or contributed to the outcome for Nikki Spriggs. One of the claims that could be asserted, and I believe reasonably asserted in this case, is that Nikki Spriggs, between 1992 and 1998, went to the A.I. DuPont Hospital on multiple occasions. She was seen sometimes for months, sometimes for weeks, but she was there regularly. And that same institution that took the position that they wanted to see her every 6 months, had it in their records, did nothing to follow up on this claim. So if the court says that that contribution claim exists, then a viable claim now exists against A.I. DuPont, which means that Dr. Reddy can sue them, and then their conduct, which occurred 13 years ago, will be the subject of an issue in litigation.
That's the A.I. DuPont joined in this litigation?
They were not. They were not. But it doesn't preclude me in terms of if there's now a judgment, I now have the ability to go back and include them as a defendant. And that's the road that we're going down by saying that I would have the ability on a contribution claim or an indemnification claim to do that. And that's the reason why all these statutes start out with an action.
Well, perhaps, you know, the answer to your scenario is that there would be a problem of claim preclusion. That is, if Dr. Reddy wanted to third party in some other potential defendant to share in the contribution, then that was something that he was procedurally obligated to do when the action in Delaware was filed.
My time is up. Can I answer that?
Yes.
Okay. You could argue, but I don't know that that necessarily precludes the claim, but it would still, let's assume that Dr. Reddy had settled the case. then I would be in the same circumstance. You still have the same issue, and defendants in this state who settle a case will then be turning around saying, okay, I got 3 years to decide if I want to sue somebody for that. And
apart from medical negligence matters, is that the law and as generally as to contribution?
Except in medical malpractice cases, it is.
Thank you. Thank you both. The court appreciates your arguments. We'll take this matter under advisement, and we'll also take a brief recess.